The capsule touched down outside one of the stone houses, a long building with age-blackened wood beams protruding from beneath a slate roof. A balcony ran along one side. Big windows were open, showing a glimpse of a very modern interior. The grass swept right up to the walls, emphasizing the impression of natural harmony. Oscar stepped out wearily. The Gaia field was resonating with a warm, subtle joy, wrapping him in a daydream of a child being swept up in its mother's arms, the comfort and security of being home. It was a welcome emanating from the people hurrying across the land to greet him. They came out of nearby houses or simply teleported in, popping into existence to enlarge the crowd. Then the horses appeared, a whole cavalry squad riding up over a nearby ridge, dressed in dark uniforms that trailed gold and scarlet heraldic streamers behind their shoulders. The horses were clad in metal mesh, with hems of gold tassels brushing the tips of the grass. He stared at the giant, fearsome beasts with their metal-clad horns and sharp tusks, memories stirring. "I've seen one of those before," he exclaimed excitedly, "on our drive to the mountains. A Charlemagne. Somebody guided us."
"Yes," Tamancio said. "We still train to fight on them, but we've never actually ridden them into battle since the planet's revenge. It's all ceremonial now, part of our skill set. The riders are here to honor your arrival, as do the King Eagles." He gestured upward.
Oscar just managed not to flinch. He did gasp, though. A flock of giant avian creatures swirled overhead, resembling the petrosaurs of Earth's dinosaur era. They had been created by the Barsoomians as part of their quest for genetic expansion. Each one had a rider dressed in long, flowing robes that fluttered behind him. They waved as they passed overhead, turning and twisting with amazing finesse. Oscar grinned unashamedly at their acrobatic antics. Surely those riders had to be strapped on. Tamancio cleared his throat discreetly.
"Perhaps a few words," he whispered into Oscar's ear.
Oscar had been so entranced by the King Eagles, he hadn't noticed how many people were gathered in front of him. He gazed across them, slightly unnerved by their appearance. It was as if some kind of athletic squad had turned out to see him. Without fail, they were tall. The men were handsome, the women beautiful, and all of them hugely fit. Even the smiling, eager children were healthy specimens. He couldn't help thinking of H.G. Wells's particular vision of the future from the Time Machine. Here in their protected Edenistic garden, the Knight's Guardians were like the Eloi, but with muscles and attitude. Heaven help the Morlock who wandered into this valley. Oscar drew a breath, really trying not to think about the media briefings he had had to give while he was in the Navy. "I haven't been to far away for a very long time. Too long, actually. You have made it a thrilling world, a world respected across the Commonwealth. For that I thank you, as I do for this welcome." The applause was heartfelt enough. Oscar bobbed his head, smiling at the earnest faces. He was hugely relieved when Tamancio ushered him into the house. The reception room was clad in what looked like translucent white fabric that emitted a mild glow. There were strange deep folds in the walls that hinted at parallel compartments. Aspects of the T-sphere, Oscar guessed. The furniture was solid enough, as was the little shrine that rested on a broad ancient wood table at the far end. Oscar slowed to a halt as he stared at the black-shrouded holographic portrait with its single candle burning underneath. The cat's prim face returned her best enigmatic smile.
"For every yin, a yang," Oscar murmured grimly. He should have known. The valley had been too idyllic.
Tamancio came up to stand beside him.
"You knew her, didn't you? You actually spoke to her as you traveled to far away.
We spent a day together on a carbon goose flying across halfway. I wouldn't say I knew her well."
"How I envy you that day.
Did she frighten you?"
"I was wary of her.
We all were."
"Perhaps you should be."
"I would not be frightened. I would be honored."
"She is evil."
"Of course she is, but she is also noble. She showed us the way. She gave the Guardians of Selfhood purpose once more. She was the one who brought us together with the Barsoomians. After the Starflyer was destroyed, after you helped kill it, Oscar, there was nothing left for our ancestors.
Bradley Johansen originally built us out of the ruin of enslavement. He forged us into warrior tribes to fight the greatest battle humans had ever known, the battle to save our entire species. And when it was over, he was dead and we were lost, doomed to wither away as a dwindling band of old soldiers without a cause, an anachronistic embarrassment as far away was civilized by the Commonwealth. Soldiers always have to hang up their weapons in the end. You don't understand. It was our ethos she rescued. She showed us that strength is a virtue, a blessing. It is our evolution and should not be denied the way the liberals of the Commonwealth do, treating it as if it were some ignominious part of us to be always denied. If we had not been strong, if Bradley had not remained steadfast, the Commonwealth would have died on the same day you did, Oscar. If the Barsoomians hadn't maintained their clarity, today's humans would be emaciated, short-lived creatures. He smiled at the portrait. One of us had strength, the other, purpose. She saw them both and combined them into a single bold principle. She gave us a vision we can remain forever true to. There is no shame in strength, Oscar. I know, Oscar said reluctantly. That's why I'm here. I had hoped that. You said you needed help. I do. He paused. What if it goes against your ideology? Damasio laughed. We don't have one, Oscar. That's the point of the Knights Guardian movement. We follow one creed. Strength. That is what we want to impart to humanity as it grows and diversifies. It is the most basic evolutionary tenet. Those sections of humanity that embrace it will survive. It's as simple as that. We are nature as raw as it can get. The fact that we are perceived as nothing other than mercenaries is not our problem. When we are hired to perform a job, we do it thoroughly. I need subtlety for this, at least to begin with. We can do subtle, Oscar. Covert operations are one of our specialties. We embrace all forms of human endeavor apart from the blatantly wicked or stupid. For instance, we won't perform a heist for you. The Knights Guardians take their oath of honor very seriously. Oscar almost started to ask about the cat and what she used to do, but decided against it. I have to find someone, and then extend them an offer of protection. That sounds very worthy. Who is it? The second dreamer. For the first time since they had met, Oscar witnessed Tomancio losing his reserve. No shit. The Knight's Guardian started to laugh. 1,200 years without you. And now you bring us this. Oscar, you were almost worth the wait. The second dreamer himself. He suddenly sobered. I won't ask why. But thank you, from the bottom of my simple heart, for coming to us. The why is actually very simple. There are too many people who wish to influence him. If he does choose to emerge from the shadows, he should be free to make his own choice. To go to the void or not. To possibly trigger the end of the galaxy in pursuit of our race's fate, or not. What a grail to guard, Oscar. What a challenge. I take it that's a yes. My team will be ready to leave in less than an hour. Will you be leading them? What do you think?
I was so sure, Araminta exclaimed. She was this mild, scatty little thing. She did everything he told her to, and I do mean everything. Face it, darling. At the time, you weren't in any position to be the perfect observer, Cressida said archly.
But it was the way she did it. You don't understand. She was eager, obedient, like the other ones, I think. Shit. Do you think he was lying to me?
Maybe she is profiled, and he told her to always give that answer. Araminta made an effort to calm down. Alcohol was a good suppressant. She tipped the wine bottle over her glass. There was none left.
Damn!
Cressida signaled the smart-suited waiter. Quite an offer, though. Yeah. What is it about men? Why are they all complete shits? I mean, what kind of mentality does that? Those women are slaves.
I know.
The waiter brought another bottle over and flipped the seal. The gentleman over there has asked if he can pay for it. Araminta and Cressida looked across toward the giant floor-to-ceiling window, which gave them a stunning view out across the luminous glow of the nighttime city. The bar was on the 35th floor of the Salamartin Hotel Tower, and attracted a lot of tourist types who thought nothing of paying the absurd bar prices. Every room in the hotel was taken by living dream followers, which was why the lobby was besieged by protesters. Araminta had forced her way through the angry chanting mob to plead with the doorman to let her in. She had been frightened. There was a strong threat of violence building up on the street. Cressida, of course, had the authorization code to land her capsule on the executive rooftop pad. The man smiling at them from a table in front of the window was dressed in natural fabric clothes, styled as only a Macathran resident would wear. "No," Araminta and Cressida chorused. The waiter smiled, understanding, and started pouring. Araminta watched morosely as her glass was filled. "Do you think I should go to the police?"
"No," Cressida said emphatically. "You do not go down that road, not ever. He sat you next to the Prime Minister at dinner for Ozzy's sake. You know how powerful he is.
Besides which, no police force on the planet would investigate him. And even if they did, they'd never be able to prove anything. Those girls, if you were right, and I'm not saying you're not, wouldn't ever be found, let alone analysed to see if their brains were wired up illegally. Forget it. How about the Commonwealth Government? Don't they have some kind of crime agency? The Intersolar Serious Crimes Directorate. So you take a trip to their local office, which is probably on Alezalin, and you walk in and say you think some of his wives might be psychoneural profiled because of how they behaved while you were all having sex together, an orgy during which, incidentally, your macrocellular clusters were running a sexual narcotic program. It wasn't a narcotic, Araminta said automatically. Point in your favour, then. That should do it. All right. What if I told them about his commercial plans, the way he's built up Albany's capacity? Tell whom?
Araminta pouted. For a friend, Cressida was not being very helpful. I'm not sure. The Industrial Association of Alezalin, or whatever it's called.
Do you think they don't know? Albany isn't something you can hide. And exactly what has that got to do with psychoneural profiling?
I don't know. Sounds more like vengeance than justice to me.
He's a shit. He deserves it.
Was he good in bed?
Araminta hoped she wasn't blushing as she concentrated on pouring more wine.
He was adequate.
Listen, darling, I'm afraid this is one of those nasty times when you just have to forget him and move on. You learned a valuable lesson, just how ruthless you have to be to get on in this sad old universe of ours.
Araminta's head collapsed down into her hands, sending her hair tumbling around her glass.
Oh, great Ozzy, I went and had sex with him. How humiliating is that?
She wished she could get rid of the memory, at least the bit about how much she had enjoyed herself. Actually, there were various commercially available routines and drugs capable of performing neat little memory edits.
Oh, stop being so self-pitying, girl. There, there.
Cressida reached over and patted Araminta's hand. By now he'll have had half a dozen more girls in his bed and won't even remember your name. It never meant as much to him as it does to you.
And you're telling me this to cheer me up?
That was his deal, wasn't it? You would be the second Friday on months with an R in them.
Yeah, I know. Hell, I'm a big girl. I knew what I was doing.
With hindsight, yes, the view is always clear.
Araminta brought her head up and grinned. Thank you for not judging. You're still a work in progress, and I think you're improving under my tuition. This was a much smaller mistake than Laryl. When you want to cheer someone up, you really go for it, don't you?
Cressida pushed her glass across the table and clinked it to the rim of Araminta's.
You're starting to understand life. That's good. So what are you going to do about Mr. Bovey?
Araminta grimaced. Mr. Bovey's proposal, actually.
What? He didn't.
He did. Marriage with me once I've gone multiple.
And you think I'm pushy? Wait a minute. Did he ask you this before you had your little visit to Lycan?
Yes.
You go, my girl. So what was the Lycan thing all about?
Trying out options while I consider what to do?
Wow.
Have you ever considered going multiple? Lycan said it was purely a lifestyle choice, not a business one.
I'm not so sure.
10 pairs of extra hands would be very useful in my line of work.
I haven't considered it, no. It's still only one mind, which is all a lawyer needs.
But if you're serious about property development, then I can see the practical advantages. It's self-limiting, though, isn't it? It's saying I'll always be somebody stuck doing some kind of manual job. Your pride seems to be a very fluid thing.
I just want... She didn't know how to finish that sentence, not at all. I don't know. I was just shaken up by what happened on the weekend, and I had this really awful dream, too.
I was like this really big creature flying over a planet when someone tried to smother me. Been having a few of those lately. Do you suppose it's stress?
Cressida gave her a puzzled look. Darling, everyone has had that dream. It was the second dreamer's dream of the Sky Lord over Querentia, and that wasn't someone trying to smother you. That was Ethan trying to talk to the Sky Lord direct. They say he's still in a coma in the hospital with his minions trying to repair his burnt-out brain.
I couldn't have dreamed that.
Why not?
I don't have Gaiamotes. It always seemed a bit silly to me, like a weak version of the Unisphere.
Cressida became very still. She pushed her glass aside and took Araminta's hand.
Are you being serious?
Serious about what?
Didn't your mother tell you?
Tell me what? Araminta felt panicky. She wanted another drink, but Cressida's grasp was surprisingly strong.
About our great-great-great-grandmother.
What about her?
It was Melanie Rescori.
After all that build-up, Araminta felt badly disappointed. She'd at least been expecting some dynasty heir, maybe old earth royalty, not someone she'd never heard of.
Oh? Who is she? A friend of the Sylphon. She was named their friend.
You know what that means? Not really, no. Araminta's knowledge of the Sylphon was a little vague, a weird humanoid race that everyone called elves. They sang gibberish and had a bizarre wormhole network that stretched across half the galaxy, allowing them literally to walk between worlds, an ability that a depressing number of humans found incredibly romantic. Few who tried to follow them down their twisting interstellar paths returned, but those who did told fanciful tales of adventure on new worlds and the exotic creatures they had found there.
Okay, Cressida said, it goes like this. The Sylphon named Ozzy their friend, too. They gave him a magic pendant which allowed him to understand their paths, and even join their communal mind, their mother home.
Ozzy? You mean our Ozzy? The one we...
Yes. Now, Ozzy being Ozzy, he broke open the pendant and figured out how the magic worked, and that it wasn't magic but quantum entanglement. So humans then started to produce Gaiamotes. Our Gaia field is basically a poor copy of the Sylphon communal mind.
Right. So where does our ancestor come into this?
Melanie was also a Sylphon friend, which actually involves a little more than just being given the pendant. Their mother home accepts your mind and shares its wisdom with you. The pendant only initiates the contact. After a while, the ability becomes natural. Well, relatively speaking, and like all magic, it's believed to be inherited.
Cressida let go of Araminta's hands and smiled softly.
You just said it wasn't magic. Of course not, but consider this. Melanie and her husband Orion came back. They had a little girl, Sophie, while they were out there walking across the galaxy. One of very few humans ever born on the paths, and certainly the first of two Sylphon friends. She was attuned to the mother home right from the start and passed the magic on to her children. Thanks to her, most of our family can feel the Gaia field, though it's weaker with our generation. But on a good night, you can sometimes sense the mother home itself. I even ventured down one of the Sylphon paths myself when I was younger. It's just outside Colwyn City in Francola Wood. I was 13. I wanted adventure. Stupid, but...
There's a Sylphon path on Vyosha.
Yes, they don't use it much. They don't enjoy planets with civilizations like ours on them.
Where does it lead?
Araminta asked breathlessly. They don't lead to any one place. They join up and twist. Time is different among them as well. That's why humans who aren't Sylphon friends are always lost along them. I was lucky. I managed to get back after a couple of days. Mother was furious with me.
So... My dreams, they're not actually mine.
That Sky Lord one the other night wasn't, no. It felt so real. Didn't it just?
She glanced pointedly around the bar, packed with living dream followers.
Now you see why they're so devout. If you're offered that kind of temptation every time you go to sleep, well, who would want to wake up? That's what the void is to them. Their dreams, forever.
I don't get it. So what if they're real? That city they always go on about, Macathran, it's medieval, isn't it? And their water walker fights all the time. That's awful. Even if you've got telepathic powers, they're not that special. Our technology is just as good. Who wants to live like that?
You seriously need to review Inigo's dreams before you make that sort of judgment. The water walker transforms an entire human society.
So he's a talented politician?
Oh no, darling. He's much more than that. He revealed the true nature of the void to us. He showed us what it can do. That kind of power scares me shitless, which is precisely what so many find so attractive.
Cressida waved her elegant hand at the Living Dream supporters.
Ozzy, help us if these dreadful little fools ever gain the same ability the Water Walker discovered. Eating up the galaxy would be the least of our worries.
Inigo's sixth dream. Nearly 80 probationary constables sat together in a block of seats on the ultra-black floor of Malphite Hall, as the vast arching ceiling above played images of wispy clouds traversing the beautiful gold and pink dawn sky. Ediard had one of the seats in the second row, and kept his head tipped back so he could watch the giant ceiling in astonishment. He was sure it must be the marvel of the world. His fellow squadmates were all amused by his reaction, not that they'd actually been in the Orchard Palace before, except for Dinley. But at least they'd known about the moving imagery, and they hadn't thought to warn him. Ediard gasped as Nikran rose up into the replica sky. The ruddy brown planet here was a lot larger than it ever appeared in Quarentia's skies. He could see tiny features etched on the world's eternal deserts. For some reason that made him think of it as an actual place rather than an element of the celestial panorama.
Does anyone live there?
He whispered to Cancine, who was in the chair next to him. She looked at him, frowning, then glanced up at the image of Nikran and giggled.
What?
Maxon hissed. Ediard wants to know if anyone lives on Nikran, Cassine announced solemnly. The whole squad snickered. Surrounding squads joined in. Ediard felt his face heating up.
Why not? He protested. Ra's ship fell onto this world. Why not another ship to Nikran?
Absolutely, Maxon said. Perfectly valid question. In fact, there's a whole other Macathran up there. Ediard ignored them and simply looked straight ahead in a dignified manner. He resolved never to tell his friends of his dreams and what they showed him. The block of probationary constables settled down. Ediard started to concentrate on what he was seeing. They were facing the grand curving staircase that dominated one side of the hall. Owen, the mayor of Macathran, had appeared at the top, followed by the guild masters and district masters who made up the upper council. They were all wearing their full ceremonial robes, producing a splendid blaze of colour as they filed down to the floor of the hall.
Oh, lady,
Dinley groaned. Ediard caught a sensation of queasiness emanating from his friend. 10 seconds maximum, he told Dinley, using a tiny directed long talk voice. Then it's all over. Just hold it together for 10 seconds. You can do that. Dinley nodded while appearing completely unconvinced. Ediard resisted looking at the much bigger block of seats behind him, where the families and friends of the probationary constables were gathered to watch them receive their bronze epaulets. It was probably an exaggeration, but half of them were Dinley's family, and all of them were in uniform.
I bet there's a crime wave going on in every district, Maxon had muttered while they were taking their seats earlier. There aren't any constables left out there to patrol.
Owen reached the platform that had been set up at the bottom of the stairs. He smiled at the attentive audience.
It is always an honour and a privilege for me to perform this ceremony, he said. In my position I hear so many people complain, not just about the state which the city is in, but of the chaos which supposedly reigns in the lands outside our crystal walls. I wish they were standing here now to see so many young people coming forward to serve their city. I am heartened by the sense of duty you are displaying in making this commitment to serve your fellow citizens.
You give me confidence for the future. Now that's a real politician, Edyard thought uncharitably. The mayor, of all people, must have known how inadequate the number of constables was, known that the 80 of them there weren't enough, that at least an equal number of constables had left in the last few months to become private bodyguards, or for a better paid and respected job as a sheriff in some provincial town. Why doesn't he do something about it? The mayor finished his inspirational speech. The probationary constables stood up as one, and then the first row trooped up to the platform to be greeted by the mayor. The chief constable read each probationer's name out to the hall, while an assistant handed a pair of epaulettes to the mayor to be presented with a handshake and a smile. Edyard's row started to move forward. He had thought that this would be boring at the least, that it was stupid, an irritation he could have done without, especially as the only person in the audience clapping for him was Salrana, who had been given a day off from her duties. But now he was here. Now he was walking up to the mayor of the entire city. He actually began to feel a sense of occasion. Behind him the audience was radiant with pride. They believed in the constables. In front, the upper council was registering its approval. None of the councillors had to be there. It was a ceremony repeated 3 times a year every year. They had been to dozens and would have to come to dozens more. If they had wanted to cry off, they could have done that. But it was important enough for them to turn out every time. And here he was himself, coming forward to make a public pledge to the citizens of Macathran that he would do his best to protect them and implement the rule of law. That was why Ra and those who followed him into office had created this ceremony and others like it, to recognize and honor the commitment the constables made to their city and lives. It was neither silly nor a waste of time. It was a show of respect. Edyard stood in front of the mayor, who smiled politely and shook his hand as the chief constable read out his name. A pair of bronze epaulettes was pressed into his hand. "Thank you, sir," Edyard said. There was a lump in his throat. "I won't let you down. Ashwell will never happen here." If the mayor was surprised, he did not show it. Edyard caught sight of Finitan standing on the grand staircase. The master of the Eggshaper Guild looked rather splendid in a gold and purple gown with elaborate scarlet symbols embroidered down the front. His silver-tipped hood was arranged over the left shoulder. He caught Edyard's eye and winked. "Well done, lad," his long talk whispered. Edyard stepped off the platform. There was a burst of applause. He nearly laughed. It was as if the audience were rejoicing that he was out of the way. In fact, it was Dinlay's considerable family clapping loudly as their relative received his epaulettes. Dinlay managed not to trip or throw up or collapse from fright. He followed Edyard back to their seats with a glowing face, grinning back at his kin. Afterward, there was a formal reception party, with the mayor and upper council mixing with the new constables and their families, while G-monkeys circled Malfit Hall with trays of drinks. It was scheduled to last an hour. Edyard might have warmed to the graduation ceremony itself, but he planned to be out of the party in under 10 minutes. "No, you don't," Salrana decreed. "Just look at who's here." Edyard frowned at the people babbling away, the families in their finery, the resplendent upper council members. "Who?" She gave him a withering look. "The Pythia, for a start. And she noticed me. I felt her farsight on me during the ceremony." Edyard took another look. "Fair enough. You're the only novice here. She probably thinks you ducked out of your assignments to pick up the free booze." Salrana drew herself up. It shifted the fabric of her white and blue robe in a way Edyard could not help noticing. If he kept doing that, and kept thinking those accompanying thoughts about how she was growing up, the lady really would blast him out of existence one day. "Edyard, you can still be disappointingly childish at times. We are both citizens of Macathran now. Today, you especially. Try and act in an appropriate fashion." Edyard's mouth dropped open. "Now we are going over to thank Grandmaster Finitan for sponsoring you, as is the right expression of gratitude, which you do feel, and see if we can be introduced to others in the upper council as well. If you're to become chief constable, you need to start paying attention to the city's political dynamics." "Yes," Edyard admitted.
Chief Constable. That's your route onto the upper council, now that you've chosen the constables over a guild. I've been graduated 8 minutes. Those that hesitate lose. The lady's book, 5th chapter.
His lips twitched. I knew that.
Did you know? Salrana raised an eyebrow. I might have to test you later.
I've had quite enough of exams these last few weeks, thank you. Poor Edyard.
Come on.
She pulled at his hand, all girlish again. Grandmaster Finnerton was talking to a pair of fellow upper council members as Edyard and Salrana approached him. He smiled and turned to them.
Congratulations, my boy. A proud day for you.
Yes, sir. Thank you again for sponsoring me.
Well, it seems to have put me in credit with the Chief Constable. You graduated 3rd in your class. That's an astonishing result for someone unfamiliar with our city.
Thank you, sir.
Allow me to introduce Masters Grayley of the Geography Guild and Imelan of the Chemistry Guild. This is Constable Edyard from the Rulan province, a friend of my old master.
Masters. Edyard bowed formally. Then he saw Salrana pluck at her skirt and hold the fabric up daintily on one side as she performed a peculiar little bow that involved bending her knees and keeping her back straight.
And novice Salrana, Finnerton said smoothly, also from Rulan.
A pleasure, Imelan said. Edyard did not care for the way the master's eyes lingered on Salrana.
You're a long way from home, novice, the master said.
No, sir, she said in a polite tone. Makathran is my home now.
Well said, novice, Finnerton said. I wish all our citizens were as appreciative of the city as you are. Now, Finnerton, Grayley chided, this is not the day. Apologies.
Finnerton inclined his head at the youngsters. So, Edyard, have you had a run-in with our criminal element yet?
A few, sir, yes. He's being very modest, sir, Salrana said. He led his squad after some thieves in the Silverham Market. He recovered the stolen items as well.
Edyard shifted awkwardly under the scrutiny of all three masters. And are these miscreants now labouring away at the Trampello mine to pay for their crime? Imelan asked. No, sir, Edyard admitted. They got away, that time. They won't again.
I imagine they won't, Finnerton said with an edge of amusement. Come along, Edyard. Let me introduce you to the mayor. It's about time he saw an honourable man again.
Sir?
Old joke. We often clash in the council.
He signalled them to follow him. Not over anything important to the lives of real people, of course. The mayor of Makathran was talking to the Pythia, just beside the little platform where he had handed out the epaulettes. If he was bored or annoyed to be introduced to a new constable, he did not show it. Edyard had never encountered a mind so perfectly shielded. Not that he paid much attention. He was entranced by the Pythia. He had been expecting some ancient woman full of grandmotherly warmth. Instead, he was disconcerted to find that the Pythia retained the beauty of a woman still awaiting her half-century, a beauty only emphasized by her gold-trimmed white robe with its flowing hood that she wore forward, casting her face in a slight shadow. Salrana did her strange bow again to the Pythia. "The lady's blessing upon you, my child," the Pythia said. She sounded bored in that way Makathran's aristocrats always did when they had to deal with those they considered to be of a lower order. That wasn't what Edyard had expected from a Pythia. Then she turned her attention to him, startlingly light blue eyes fixed on him, surrounded by a mass of thick bronze hair twined with gold and silver leaves. The eyes narrowed in judgment, which Edyard found heartbreaking. He felt like he had disappointed her, which was a terrible thing. Then she smiled, banishing his worry.
"Now you are interesting, Constable," she said. "My lady," he stammered. He somehow could feel the Pythia's farsight on him, as if she were picking through his mind. There was something disconcertingly intimate about the contact, and she was very beautiful, merely a yard away, her half-smile open and inviting.
Salrana made a groaning sound in her throat.
"I'm not quite that exalted," the Pythia said lightly. "There is only one true lady. My usual form of address is Dear Mother."
"I apologize, Dear Mother. Think nothing of it. You've come a long way to get here, and you still have a long way to travel."
"I do."
But the Pythia had turned to face Finnerton.
What a fascinating young friend you have, Grandmaster.
I'm pleased you think so, Pythia.
So young, yet so strong.
The way she said it sent a shudder of felonious delight down Eddiard's spine. He didn't dare glance in her direction. Instead, he fixed his gaze on the mare, who was frowning.
Do you foresee great things for him? Finnerton asked jovially.
The Pythia turned to stare directly at Eddiard, an act he could not ignore, not in a group like this, not without appearing extraordinarily rude. He tried to return the look, but found it incredibly difficult.
Your potential is very strong, she said. There was an almost teasing quality to her voice. Do you follow the lady's teachings, Constable Eddiard?
I try my best, dear mother.
I'm sure you do. May she bless your endeavours in your new duties.
Eddiard almost did not hear her. A movement behind Finnerton had caught his eye. In horror, he watched Mistress Florel heading toward them, all black chiffon and wide veils hanging from a tall hat. His dismay must have leaked out. As one, Finnerton, the mayor, and the Pythia turned to acknowledge the approaching Grand Dame.
Aunt! The mayor exclaimed happily. How lovely of you to come! He's the one!
Mistress Florel declared in her scratchy voice,
the young hooligan who nearly knocked me to the ground. Now, aunt, take his epaulets away, she snapped imperiously. He's not fit to serve this city. Time was we used to have men of good character in the constables, the sons of noblemen.
The mayor gave Eddiard a half-apologetic look.
What happened, constable?
I was pursuing some thieves, sir. Mistress Florel came out of a building. I went around.
Ha! Tried to run over me, more like.
Come, come, aunt. The lad was obviously just doing his job. A conscientious chap like this is just what we need. Suppose the thieves had snatched your bag. Wouldn't you want him to give chase?
Nobody would steal my bag, she snapped.
I am sorry for any distress, Eddiard said desperately. The horrible old woman just wouldn't listen. The mayor shuffled around to stand between Mistress Florel and Eddiard, flicking his fingers in a go-away motion. Eddiard did a kind of half-bow and backed away fast, accompanied by Salrana and Finnerton. Aunt, you know it's bad for you to dwell on such trivia. Now, some of these Mindala Estate fortified wines are really quite lovely. You must try. There was a note of tired desperation in his voice. Finnerton smiled broadly as they hurried off.
Thank you, Eddiard. These reception parties are normally quite tedious.
Yes, sir.
Oh, come now. This is your graduation day. Don't let that daft old bat spoil it for you. She's embarrassingly well connected, as you would be if you clung to life for so long. Wouldn't surprise me if she did drink the blood of virgins after all. Your pardon, novice.
I've heard of Mistress Florel, sir, Salrana said.
Everyone in the city has, Finnerton said. That's why she thinks she's so important, instead of just old and obnoxious.
He put his hand on Eddiard's shoulder. And I say that as her great-great-nephew myself, twice removed, thankfully.
Thank you, sir, Eddiard said.
Now off you go and enjoy yourselves. And Eddiard, when the time comes for you to apply for promotion to officer rank, come and see me again. I'll be happy to sign the letter.
Sir?
Eddiard asked incredulously.
You heard. Now be off with the pair of you. It's a bold, bad city out there. Have fun.
Eddiard did not need telling again. He and Salrana made for the hall's big archway, which led out to the antechambers.
Hey, Eddiard! Maxon called, hurrying to intercept him. Where are you off to?
Just out, Eddiard said.
He didn't even want to glance over his shoulder in case Mistress Florel was looking his way. Maxon reached them and skidded to a halt.
Mother and Dybal are taking me to the Rakus restaurant to celebrate. It's an open invitation to my squad mates as well.
Maxon stopped and smiled at Salrana.
Novice? I had no idea Eddiard kept such pleasant company.
He gave Eddiard an expectant look, ever the injured party.
This is Novice Salrana from my home village, Eddiard said sulkily.
That is one village I'm definitely going to have to visit. Maxon bowed deeply.
Why is that, Constable? She asked.
To see if all the girls there are as beautiful as yourself.
She laughed. Eddiard groaned, glaring in warning at Maxon.
The invitation to Rekus is, of course, extended to the friends of my squad mates, novice. The friends accept with thanks, she said primly, but only if you stop calling me novice. It will be my delight, Selrana, and I will also beg you to tell of Edyard's early life. It would seem he's been keeping secrets from us. Those who entrust our lives to him, no less. Shocking, she agreed. I will entertain such a request, if correctly made. Selrana! A horrified Edyard exclaimed. Excellent, Maxon said. I'll arrange another gondola for our party. Now, Edyard, where is Cantsine?
Edyard glowered at his so-called friend.
Edyard? Selrana prompted with a jab to his ribs.
Over there, Edyard said it without having to concentrate. Through his farsight he was automatically aware of all his squadmates, a trait Che always tried to emphasize. He pointed to where Cantsine was chatting with a heavily pregnant woman and a man in a smart tunic with the crest of the Shipwrights Guild. Her sister came to the ceremony. They're catching up.
No sign of her mother then, poor thing, Maxon said sadly.
Ah, well, I'll go and ask her.
Boyd's family are all here, Edyard said. And will yet sink under the weight of Dinley's relatives, Maxon concluded. So it's just us precious few left. See you at the Outer Circle canal mooring in 10 minutes.
What did you say that for?
Edyard asked as Maxon walked over to Cantsine. Selrana cocked her head to one side and gave him a very haughty look. It was a gesture of honest friendship. Why should I not accept? He was flirting with you. She grinned. Wasn't he just?
You're a novice.
We are not professional virgins, Edyard. I seem to remember us kissing. And more, wasn't there a discussion about my age and when you would be ready to bed me?
Edyard turned bright red. His farsight tried to sense sparks of interest in those standing closest. Either they could shield too well or they had not overheard. One thing was sure, she wouldn't back down. She never has. Her voice would only grow louder if he persisted. I don't wish to recall that day too closely, if you don't mind. However, if I've offended you, I apologize. I still think of you as my charge, especially after all we have been through, which is why I overreacted with Maxen. Truly, Selrana, he's had more girls than I have socks. Her smile was forgiving.
I've seen your wardrobe. You only have 2 pairs of socks.
I do not. And they have holes in them. So you just concentrate on worrying about yourself, Edyard. I know and understand all about Maxen and boys like him. That's why he's perfectly harmless.
He's perfectly charming.
It's not a crime, you know. Perhaps if you showed a little more charm, then you could boast of more conquests.
Charm, eh?
He bent his arm and extended it toward her.
May I escort you to the mooring, novice Selrana?
Why, thank you, Constable Edyard. You may indeed.
She linked her arm through his and allowed him to lead her out of the hall.
The Rakus restaurant was in the Abad district, which meant a gondola ride down the great major canal. It was the first time Edyard had been in one of the elegant black boats. He didn't have the coinage to travel in them ordinarily. Money, clearly, was not an issue with Dybal. The errant musician was everything Edyard had expected, wild black hair reaching halfway down his back, barely contained by red leather bands that gave it a peculiar ropey appearance. A long face had weather-beaten creases and sunken cheeks above a narrow jaw. But with brown-gold eyes that always seemed to be seeing the funny side of life as they peeped over narrow blue-lens glasses, his whole mental order was agreeable, akin to that of a carefree adolescent, rather than a man well over 100. Just being able to say hello and shake hands was enough to banish Edyard's lingering dismay over Mistress Florel. As their little group assembled at the moorings, Dybal made them all feel welcome, even though they'd never met him before. He instinctively knew the right note to take with each of them.
"Come on, then," he said loudly once they were all present, and led them down the steps.
His clothes were large, even though he was improbably slender for his age. Edyard imagined they needed to be that big to contain his ebullience. He certainly achieved the whole larger-than-life image effortlessly enough. Strident voice, big arm gestures, fur-lined velvet jacket, paisley shirt and leather trousers,
their colours mimicking those of the Musicians' Guild, or more likely, a deliberate mockery of them. Edyard was only slightly disappointed that the musician wasn't carrying his guitar. He wanted to hear the songs of rebellion that stoked up Macathron's youth. Dybal took the first gondola, along with Maxen and Bijuli, Maxen's mother. Edyard watched him talk to the gondolier, holding the man's hand between his two palms, squeezing intently. Both men laughed, the kind of low merriment that usually came from a dirty joke. Dybal took his seat beside Bijuli, while the still-smiling gondolier pushed off. "That is Maxen's mother?" Cansine asked, as they settled on the middle bench in their own gondola. "Yeah," Edyard said, and to think a few minutes earlier he had believed the Pythia was an attractive older woman. "Maxen introduced me just before you arrived." That had gone a long way to making his world a better place. "Can't be," Cansine declared, as their gondola slipped out onto the Great Major Canal. "That would mean she had him when she was, what, 10? She looks like she's my age, for the lady's sake." Edyard sat back on the bench, smiling. He was so content, he came this close to putting his arm around Salrana, who was sitting next to him. "Do I hear the little voice of envy there, Constable?" "You hear the little voice of disbelief," Cansine muttered. "Perhaps it's his sister, and I misheard. How does she keep her skin so fresh? It's got to be some ointment, only available to the rich. Maybe she imports it direct from Nycran." Cansine pulled a face. "You too," Salrana laughed. "You're like an old married couple." Edward and Cansine carefully avoided each other's gaze. The gondola already had reached Birmingham Pool, the big junction at the top of the Grand Central Canal. From Edyard's position, the entire circle of water seemed to be full of gondolas dodging one another as they slipped in and out of the various canals emptying into the pool. He did his best not to flinch. None of the gondoliers were slowing down. They seemed to know instinctively where to go. Kraft slipped past them close enough to touch, if he had been brave enough to stretch out an arm. Then they arrived at the head of the Grand Central Canal, and their gondolier gave a hard push on his punt. The first thing Edyard looked at was the mooring on his right, where the thieves had escaped. He caught Cansine looking at it too. She gave him a tiny shrug. Then he forgot all about it, and enjoyed the view. At the top end of the city, along the Silverham, Haxburn, and Padua districts, the canal was lined with some of the grandest buildings in Macathran, palaces up to 10 stories high with huge windows, their facades a swirl of colour in weird patterns. Turrets, belvederes, and spires produced a serrated skyline. G-eagles bigger than any Edyard had ever sculpted flew in lazy circles around the pinnacles, keeping watch on the approaches to each magnificent family seat. Cansine pointed out some of them, the palace that was home to the mayor's family, and the ziggurat where Ra and the lady were supposed to have lived, now home to the Culverit family, who claimed direct lineage. She whispered about one red-tinged facade, where Maxen's father had lived. When Edyard glanced at the gondola in front, both Maxen and Bijuli were looking in the opposite direction. All the stately buildings had low water-level archways, leading into the warren of cellars underneath, guarded by thick iron gates that the families maintained in excellent order. The walls of the Purdard family's palace were at an angle, actually overhanging the water. When Edyard looked up, he saw a glassed-in mirror door running the length of the upper story, with several youngsters standing there watching the gondolas. "A fabulously rich trading family," Cansine said, "with a fleet of 30 ships. They passed through the high pool, which provided a junction with Flight Canal and Market Canal. There was a bridge on either side of the pool. The first one was the city's, a simple high white arch to which carpenters had attached a broad rail along both sides. Famously, the apex was a 10-yard stretch of crystal, providing a view directly past any pedestrian's shoes down onto the water and the gondolas 30 yards below. Not everyone could walk across it. The sight was too much for some, as many as 1 in 20, the Doctor's Guild claimed. At Che's insistence, Edyard and the rest of the squad had used it several times on patrol. Edyard had had to gird himself to walk those few invisible yards. The vertigo wasn't strong enough to stop him, though it was unpleasant.
all the squadmates had forced themselves across it. Surprisingly, Dinlay had been the least affected. The bridge on the other side of Highpool was constructed out of iron and wood, a bulky, creaking thing in comparison to its cousin, yet with far more traffic. Past the pool, the towers of Eyrie stabbed up into the clean azure sky, as if ready to impale any passing skylord. Fiacre District's cliff-like frontage swarmed with vine plants, with long strands of flowers bubbling out of the emerald and russet leaves. Only the windows remained clear of foliage, producing deep-set black holes in the lush living carpet. The gondolas pulled up at a mooring just beyond Forest Pool, and everyone climbed out. Dybal paid the gondoliers, and they all set off to the round tower that housed the Rakus restaurant on its third floor. Hansalt, the owner and chief chef, had reserved for Dybal a table beside a long window overlooking one of the district's colourful plazas.
"An auspicious day for us," Dybal announced, as a waitress brought over a tray with chilled white wine. "First, a toast to your squad, Maxon. May you rid the city of crime."
They drank to that. Ediard gave the glass a suspicious glance. He'd never seen wine with bubbles in it before, but when he sipped it, the taste was surprisingly light and fruity. He rather liked it. "Secondly," Dybal said, "to Ediard, for being appointed squad leader." Ediard blushed.
"Speech?" Maxon demanded.
"Not a chance," Ediard grunted. They laughed and drank to that.
"Thirdly,"
his voice softened, and he looked down at Bidjuli, "I am very proud to announce that my beloved has agreed to marry me." The cheer that went up made all the other customers look over at them. Everyone saw that it was Dybal and smiled knowingly. Maxon was hugging his mother. Ediard and Salrana were astonished, but clinked glasses anyway and downed some of the bubbling wine. Another 2 chilled bottles arrived and were poured out quickly. Afterward, Ediard always thought back to that meal as the first time he had been truly happy since Ashwell. The food was like nothing he'd ever eaten before. It arrived on big white plates, arranged with such artistry that he almost did not want to eat it. But when he did tuck in, the combination of tastes was marvellous. And Dybal had gossip about the city's elite that was downright scandalous. That all started because of Salrana, who was answering Maxon's question about what novices did all day long. "I mean no disrespect to the lady," he said, "but surely it must be boring just reading her scriptures and singing in her church."
"Hey," Dybal objected, "less mockery about singing, if you don't mind."
"I've been assigned to the Millikel house," Salrana said. "I love looking after the children. They're so sweet." "What's Millikel house?" Ediard asked.
"A school." "You don't know?" Bidjuli asked. She was uncertain if Ediard was making a joke.
"I told your mother," Maxon said. "He really is from a village on the edge of the wilds."
"Millikel is an orphanage," Salrana said solemnly. "I cannot understand why any mother would give up her baby, especially the ones as gorgeous as we get in the nursery. But they do. So the lady takes care of them. It's a fantastic place, Ediard. The children lack for nothing. Macathren really cares."
Dybal gave a certain cough. "Actually, that's a rather exceptional orphanage."
"What do you mean?"
Salrana said.
"You sure you want to hear this?"
Salrana twirled the stem of her wine glass between her fingers, giving Dybal a level gaze. "We do take in anyone."
"Yes, I suppose so. But it helps that you're in the Lilylight district. Consider who your neighbours are. You see, Ediard, Millikel House is where the noble families deliver those little unwanted embarrassments which happen when the younger sons are out enjoying themselves with the lower-order girls at the more disreputable entertainment theatres that grace our fine city."
"The kind you play at?" Bidjuli asked mildly.
"Yes, my love, the kind I play at." He eyed the 3 young constables. "Been to any yet?"
"Not yet," Kansin said.
Maxon kept quiet. "Just a matter of time.
Anyway, the reason Millikel is so well-funded is the tradition that the family concerned makes a donation, anonymous, of course, each time a babe is left on the house's charity step for the novices to take in.
Any money for children is distributed equally among all the ladies' orphanages," Salrana said.
I am sure a great deal of the bequests filter down to the other orphanage houses, and the lady performs invaluable work caring for such unfortunates, as I do know. But if you ever get to work in any of the other houses, you'll notice the difference. And how do you know for sure? Bidjuli asked teasingly. Dybald turned to face her with a sad smile. Because I grew up in one.
Really?
Maxon said. That's right. Which is why I'm so impressed with you, four youngsters. You came from nothing, especially Edyard and Salrana here, and you're all making a life for yourselves. I admire that. I truly do. You're not dependent on anyone, let alone a decadent family. I know I'm the first to complain about the city's hierarchy, the way democracy has been expropriated by the rich, but there are some institutions which are still worthwhile. People need the constables for the security you bring to the streets and canals, and the lady for hope.
I thought that was what your music brought, Salrana said with a cheeky gleam in her eye.
It depends which class you belong to. If you're rich, I'm a delicious wicked rebel, hot and dripping with sarcasm and irony. They have to pay me to perform, which I'm glad to do for them. But for the rest of the city, the people who toil their whole life to make things work, I'm a focal point for resentment. I articulate their feelings. For them, I sing for free. I don't want their coinage. I want them to spend it on themselves, so they don't have to give away their children.
So you compete with the lady, Salrana said.
I offer a mild alternative, that's all. Hopefully an enjoyable one.
I must try and get to one of your performances.
I'll be happy to escort you, Maxon said. I'll hold you to that, she retorted before Edyard could intervene. He did not say anything, not there and then, that would spoil the meal.
Do you know all the Grand Council? Edyard asked Dybal.
Oh, yes. They think that by associating with me, they gain credibility. What they're actually doing by inviting me to their homes is contributing generously to lyrics of irony and hypocrisy. Why do you ask, Edyard? Do you need to know about their mistresses, their strange shared interest in taxing cotton production in Fondral province, the scandal over funds for the militia, the money wasted on official functions, the disease of corruption which infects the staff of the Orchard Palace who are supposed to be impartial, how our dear Mayor Owen is already buying votes for the next election, the one time he needs public support?
Actually, no. I was wondering about Mistress Florel.
Edyard has met her, Maxon said with a chortle.
We all did, while we were on duty, Edyard countered. She hit him with her umbrella, Kansin added dryly.
Dybal and Bidjuli laughed at that.
The old witch tried to get Edyard thrown out of the constables, Salrana said hot-cheeked. At the ceremony today, she told the mayor to take his epaulets back.
How typical, Dybal said. Don't worry, Edyard. She has no real power, not anymore. She's a figurehead for the noble families, that's all. They like to make out she's a much-loved grandmother to the whole city. Total crap, of course. She was a scheming little bitch when she was younger, which admittedly is history to all of us now. But she had three husbands before her 50th birthday, all first sons of district masters, which is just about unheard of, even today. She gave each of them two sons, and some say there was witchery in that. And by strange coincidence, all three second children went on to marry noble daughters in families where the male lineage had faltered in favor of the girls. By the next generation, she'd spread her brood through 11 district master families. With that kind of power block in the upper council, she controlled the votes for decades. Our last so-called Golden Age, which saw the rise of the militia at the expense of all other arms of government. You see, she believes there's no actual physical difference between the nobility and those without their obscene wealth. In other words, her offspring are born to rule and bring order to the uncivilized masses, such as thee and me. Needless to say, she doesn't believe that we should have anything to do with the city's government. That sort of thing is best left to those whom destiny has blessed with good blood.
No wonder she didn't like you, Edyard, Maxon grinned. You're not even city-born. She could probably smell the countryside on you.
Not everyone in the upper council believes in that, do they? Edyard asked, thinking of Finnetan. A nephew, he had said. Hopefully not. There are still a few decent noblemen around today.
And, of course, district masters' seats on the upper council are checked by the guild masters. And the lower council itself is still directly elected. Not that you'd know it in some districts. That makes for a lot of genuine debate in the Grand Council. Ra knew what he was doing when he crafted our constitution. But your songs are still popular. They are. Dissatisfaction with those who rule is always attractive to the majority. It's an obsession which humans brought with them on the ships which fell to Quarentia. As a species, we find it as easy as breathing. And it's never helped by old men like me who reminisce on how things were always better in our lost youth. You're a rabble-rouser, you mean? Bidjuli said fondly, as she ran her hand through his ragged braids of hair. And proud of it! Dybul raised his glass again. To making our master's lives a misery. The whole table drank to that.
So what's the story with you and Selrana? Kansine asked.
It was late at night. The celebratory lunch had lasted all afternoon. Ediard had not wanted it to end. He was perfectly relaxed, thanks to that lovely wine with bubbles, the company of friends, eating fine food, and making happy, intelligent conversation. No, this was a day that, if the lady were kind, should last and last. But as was the way of all things, they finished the final bottle of wine, ate the last morsel of cheese, and bade one another farewell. Dybul winced theatrically when the bill arrived. The sun had set outside, leaving the city's cold orange lighting to bathe the streets, along with the faint haze of the nebulae overhead. Ediard announced that he would walk Selrana back to Milikal House in the Lilylight district. As it was directly between Abad and Jeevan's, Kansine offered to walk with them. The orphanage house was a nice one, close to the Victoria Canal, with its own garden and play yard. Yet he could not help noticing that it was the smallest building on the street. Selrana had given him a light peck on the cheek before scooting off through the imposing doors that filled the entrance arch. Ediard and Kansine continued together, using a bridge over Castoff Canal to put them in the Droop district, where the palaces matched anything along the great major canal. It was quiet on those districts' narrow streets and broad squares. Bodyguards stood imposingly outside the iron gates of the palaces. Ediard tried not to stare as they passed the alert figures in dark uniforms. He was sure that staying a constable was better than such monotonous duty night after night. That disapproval must have escaped his shielding. "That's not what I'll be doing," Kansine said quietly, as their footfalls echoed around them in a narrow street, high enough to block out all the night sky, except for the slim violet thread of Buluku's meandering tail. None of them are ex-constables. They're estate workers and farm boys who've come to the city in search of a better life. They only last a couple of years before they make their way back home. That, or migrate into Sampaloc. Could have been me then, Ediard said. Somehow I doubt that.
They walked over the third bridge across the Marble Canal and back into the familiar territory of Jeevan's. Gondolas slid past quietly underneath them, small white lanterns glowing on the front. The passengers snuggled under the canopy, enjoying the romance of the ride. By then Ediard could recognize the wind rising from the sea, the moisture it carried. Clouds were scudding overhead, starting to veil the nebulae. It would rain tonight, in another hour, he decided as he smelled the air. The constable's tenement was two streets away from the Jeevan station, a big ugly building from the outside, but wrapped around a central oval courtyard, boasting a pool of warmish water large enough to swim in and overlooked by four levels of walkways. It contained the maisonettes reserved for the constables. Those with families had taken over one end, with the bachelors at the other. Not that it was a fixed divide. Ediard, along with the rest of the squad, had moved in a couple of days earlier. Each morning he had been woken by children shouting outside his door as they raced along the walkway, playing some exciting game of chase. Now the children were in bed as he and Kansine walked up a set of awkward rounded stairs to the third level, where they both had maisonettes. No real story, he told her. You know Selrana and I travelled here together. I'm sort of like her older brother. She's in love with you.
What?
I was watching her this afternoon. It's obvious to anyone with half a brain. Even Maxon fathomed it. Didn't you notice? He'd stopped trying to flirt with her by the time the fish course arrived. There's no point. She's only interested in you.
She's smart enough to realize how shallow he is, that's all. If they don't fall at his feet in the first 5 minutes, he moves on. You know what he's like. I never thought I'd see you in denial. It's not denial. You asked a question and I answered it. They stopped at the top of the stairs and looked out over the extensive courtyard. The rim of the pool was a thin, intense line of pale orange. It made the water look very inviting. Ediard knew that a lot of the constables went for a nighttime dip. His stomach was too heavy from a whole afternoon of binging, he decided reluctantly. "Actually, you didn't answer," Cansine said. "All you admitted to was knowing her, which doesn't shed any light on your relationship at all." "Ladies, save me, you really did take in all of Master Solorin's lectures, didn't you? My grades were almost as high as yours, yes. So on that long trip through the mountains and across swamps filled with monsters, did you sleep with her?"
"No."
"Why not? She's very pretty and slim. I've seen what your eye lingers on when we're out on patrol. She's far too young for a start, and she's getting pretty. Doctors in Macathran have better ointments than we had on the caravan."
"Ediard!"
Cansine gave a small, shocked laugh. "I think that's the most evil thing I've ever heard you say about anyone, let alone your little sister." "Lady, you're cruel. I don't answer a question to your satisfaction, and you say I'm in denial. Then I give an honest answer, and you brand me evil." She sucked contritely on her lower lip. "Sorry, but you can understand why." "Not really." Ediard was looking at her profile, in the coppery shimmer thrown off by the surface of the pool. In such a light she looked almost aristocratic, with her strong chin and slight nose, skin painted enticingly dark. She turned to face him, cocking her head slightly to one side in that questioning way he enjoyed. He leaned forward and kissed her. She pressed in against him, hand sliding over his back. For once he dropped his mental guard, showing her how much he delighted in the touch of her, the closeness. After a long time, they ended the kiss. Her nose rubbed against his cheek, and she let him sense how much that meant to her. "Come to bed with me," he murmured. His tongue darted out to lick the lobe of her ear. She shivered from the contact. Hot lines of pleasure flickered across her mind. He was delightfully aware of her breasts against his chest and hugged her closer. "This is going to be the best ever."
"No,"
she said. Her shoulders dropped, and she rested her hands against his shoulders, moving them apart to end the embrace.
"I'm sorry, Ediard. I feel a lot for you. I really do. You know that. That's the trouble."
"What do you mean?"
"We could work, you and me. I really think we could. Lovers, then marriage, children, everything. I'm not afraid of that. It's just the timing. It's wrong."
"Timing? I don't think you're ready for a long-term commitment yet, and I certainly don't need another fling, not with someone I care about." "It wouldn't have to be a fling. I'm ready to settle down with someone as important to me as you are."
"Oh, lady, you're sweet," she sighed. "No, Ediard, I can't compete against the ideal of Salrana. You're closer to her than you know or will admit. How could you not be, after all the two of you shared? I'm not jealous, well, not exactly. But she's always going to be there between us until you sort your feelings out. She's just a kid from the same village, that's all. Open your feelings to me. Show me your naked mind and say you don't want to bed her. You don't want to know the feel of her against you."
No, this is stupid. You're accusing me of, I don't know, having dreams. This world is full of opportunities. Some we grasp, others we pass by. It's not me who's scared of what might be. You need to look at your own feelings."
They were standing apart now, voices not raised but firm. "I know my own feelings," she said, "and I want yours to match mine. That means I can wait. You're worth waiting for, Ediard, however long it takes. You mean that much to me."
"Well, that's got to be the craziest way of showing it ever," he said, trying not to let the hurt affect his voice. His mind hardened against releasing any emotion, which was difficult given the turmoil she had kindled.
"Tell her,"
Cansine said simply. She reached out to stroke his cheek, but he dodged back.
"Be true to yourself, Ediard. That's the you I want. Good night,"
he said stiffly. Cansine nodded, then turned away. Ediard was sure he saw a tear on her cheek. He refused to use his farsight to check. Instead, he went into his maisonette and threw himself on the too high bed. Anger warred with frustration in his mind. He imagined Salrana and Cansine fighting, an image that quickly took on a life outside his control. His fist thumped the pillow. He turned over and sent his farsight swirling out across the city, observing the vast clutter of minds as they wrestled with their own demons. It felt good not to be suffering alone. He took a long time to fall asleep.
Rumour has it the Pythia uses her concealment ability to twist her features. She is over 150, after all. She could give Mistress Florella run for her money in the Withered Crone Stakes. There has to be some kind of devilment involved to make her look the way she does.
Boyd put a lot of emphasis on that last sentence, dipping his head knowingly.
Can you do that?
A startled Ediard asked.
I don't know.
Boyd lowered his voice. They say the Grand Masters can completely conceal themselves from view. I've never seen it myself.
Ediard paused on the threshold of pointing out the slight logical flaw in that admission.
Right. They were on patrol in Jeevans, walking alongside the Brotherhood Canal, which bordered the southern side of the district. Beyond the water was Tycho, not strictly a district, but a wide strip of meadow between the canal and the crystal wall. Wooden stables used by the militia squatted on the grass, the only buildings permitted on the common land. He could see stable boys cantering horses and G-horses along sandy tracks, the morning exercise they and their predecessors had performed for centuries. Several horses had G-wolves running alongside. It was their sixth patrol since graduation, 6 days during which he and Cansine barely had exchanged a word. They'd been perfectly civil to each other, but that was all. He did not want that. He wanted them at least to go back to how it was before that messed-up evening. How they might arrive back at that comfortable old association was a complete mystery, one he definitely was not going to consult the others on. He got the impression they already guessed that something had happened. Knowing them, they'd royally screw up that speculation. For some reason, he'd also held off saying anything to Salrana. Grudgingly, he acknowledged that Cansine did have a small point there. He really was going to have to face up to the whole friends-become-lovers issue simmering between him and Salrana. It wasn't fair to her. She was growing up into a beautiful adolescent, so much more vivacious than any of the city girls he encountered. All he had to do was get over his notion of protectiveness. That was stupid, too. She was old enough to look out for herself and make her own choices. The only person who had appointed him her guardian was himself, something he had done out of obligation and friendship. To do anything different, especially now, could be considered taking advantage. Sometimes you have to do what's wrong to do what's right. And physically, he knew they would be fantastic together. That body, and as for those legs. Altogether, too much time of late was spent thinking about how her legs would feel wrapped around him, long athletic muscles flexing relentlessly. It would end with them both screaming in pleasure. We wouldn't even get out of bed for the first year. Then after that, after the passion, they'd still enjoy each other's company. Salrana was the only person he could ever really talk to. They understood each other. Two hick kids against the city, future mayor, future Pythia. He smiled warmly. Of course, I could just talk to myself instead, an irritated Maxon said. Sorry, what? Ediard asked, banishing the smile. Maxon glanced over at Cansine, who was standing beside Dinley, the pair of them looking down on a gondola full of crates, calling something to the gondolier.
Boy, she really worked you over, didn't she?
Who? Oh, no. There's nothing wrong. Cansine and I are fine. I'd hate to see you unfine. Really, I'm good.
What did you want?
The shopkeepers in Bolton Street keep seeing strangers are walking along, checking out the buildings with strong farsight. They're obviously a gang taking a scouting trip. So if we go up there in these uniforms, we'll scare them off, and they'll just come back in a week or a month, whenever we move on. But if we were to loiter around in ordinary clothes, they wouldn't know we were there,
and then we could catch them at it red-handed. I don't know. You know what Ronark is like about wearing the uniform on duty. As they were starting their third patrol, the captain had appeared unexpectedly and performed a snap inspection. Ediard almost had been demoted for the disgraceful lack of standards. Since then, he had made sure his squadmates were properly dressed before leaving the station.
Exactly, Maxon said. If you're a constable in Jeevans, you have to be in a uniform. Everyone knows that. So they won't be expecting us out of uniform.
Maybe. Let me talk to Che first. See what he thinks.
He'll say no, Boyd told him. You know procedure. If a crime is suspected, then you use G-Eagles to observe the area while the squad waits out of farsight range.
We don't know how long we'll have to wait, Maxon said, and Ediard has only one G-Eagle.
You can scout more, can't you? Boyd said. You told us you used to be an egg-shaper apprentice.
He can't scout without a guild license. Not in Macathran, Maxon said. It's the law. We'd wind up having to arrest him. You know how keen they are on maintaining their monopoly. In any case, this is going to happen soon. We don't have time to scout G-Eagles. That's why we have to go patrolling in disguise.
Ordinary clothes aren't a disguise, Boyd protested.
It doesn't matter what clothes we wear as long as it's not the uniform, Maxon said, his temper rising.
Dress how you want, maybe in a dress. You're certainly acting like an old woman.
Good one, smart ass. If this gang's as clever as you say, they'll know all our faces anyway.
Enough, Ediard said, holding up his hands. I will speak to Che as soon as we get in. Until then, I'll keep my G-Eagle close to Bolton Street. I can't do anything more in the middle of a patrol, so drop it for now, please.
Just a suggestion, Maxon grumbled as he started to walk away.
Are you deliberately bugging him? Ediard asked Boyd.
The lanky boy gave a sly grin.
I don't have to answer that. I'm not under oath.
Ediard laughed. The Boyd of 6 months ago would never have dared any mischief at another's expense, let alone a friend.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.